jazz is not dead. It just sucks.
Hello, you're listening to the podcast version of Deutsche Vlog, a series of interviews, conversations with scholars in the field of media studies. My name is Mark Deutsche, and I'm your host. And the music you're listening to is my band, Skinflower. Hi, welcome. Welcome to this new episode of my Deutsche Vlog, where I interview media professionals and media scholars from around the world. And today I am joined in this special session by Ingi Smets and Christian Allen. And Ingi and Christian, I've known them for quite a while. They're incredibly generous with their time, despite the fact that they are in both in leadership positions in different parts of the world at top game studios that in one way or another most of us have heard of. So to let me introduce them briefly, Ingi is the studio director at Guerrilla Games in Amsterdam, the Netherlands. She's overseen highly successful titles such as the Killzone series, first-person shooter, and of course the Horizon Zero Dawn series, the new edition of which is shipping mid-February 2022. Guerrilla is the result of a merger between three video game studios, Orange Games, Digital Infinity, and Formula Game Development. And Ingi worked as a designer at a global marketing and technology agency, Lost Boys, and joined Guerrilla after the merger in 2003 to start work on the very first Killzone game, which was released in 2004. She became joined studio head in 2019. Guerrilla signed an exclusive agreement with Sony and in subsequent years has developed more successful iterations of the Killzone series to increasing critical acclaim and then unleashing Horizon Zero Dawn onto the world, which in 2017, an action role-playing game exclusive to the Sony PlayStation, later on in 2020 ported to Microsoft Windows as well, winning just about every award the game industry has, including BAFTA Awards, Writers Guild of America Award, DICE, Game Developers Choice, IGDA, and so on and so forth, and selling well over 10 million copies worldwide, making it one of the best-selling PlayStation games. My other guest is Christian Allen. Christian Allen is an equally award-winning game designer working on AAA games throughout his career and creative director. He's currently the Unreal Engine evangelist for North America for Epic Games. Epic Games, of course, known throughout the world for Fortnite. Christian has served as a lead designer, creative director, and design director of several AAA game projects for major studios such as Ubisoft, Red Storm Entertainment, Microsoft, Bungie, and Warner Brothers, as well as running his own development and consultancy studio, Sirelin, which, for example, used crowdfunding to ship Takedown Red Saber on PC and Xbox in 2013, and independently published a title on Steam called Epsilon in late 2015. Christian has also worked on VR projects and has consulted on many, many different occasions, including in the Hollywood film industry. Some of the titles that he's known for, that he's worked on, are the award-winning Ghost Recon Advanced Warfighter game series and Halo Reach. All in all, the games that he's been involved in have shipped over 15 million units, earning Game of the Year awards and nominations all over the world. And Christian is also a veteran of the United States Army, Marine, and Navy. And together, Angie and Christian are, of course, on the top of that game in the game industry, overseeing titles and projects at the moment. The new iteration of Horizon Zero Dawn and the Unreal 5 engine that truly transform gaming as well as the other industries. Such as filmmaking and television production, that is increasingly using the insights and the technologies developed by the games and the studios that Angie and Christian represent to further their work. And with them, so I talk about, of course, the intricacies of participating, managing, overseeing these kind of multi-million-dollar titles. Their reflections on spending 20 years or more in the game industry and what they've learned in the process, their ideas about the issues facing the game industry for it being such a young industry compared to all the other ones, but also an industry that is increasingly and at a rapid pace becoming more successful than all the other game and other media industries. Fascinating, exciting discussion, and I hope you'll enjoy this as much as I did. Hello, welcome Angie, welcome Christian. Really, really good to see you, both of you. Angie calling in from Amsterdam, I'm assuming, and
yes.
And great, welcome, and with a beautiful Horizon appropriate background. And Christian, I see you doing the Unreal thing from Seattle, Washington.
Yes, sir, got it going.
And well, I mean, okay, before we talk about anything else, you're wearing the cap, Christian. You're, of course, working for Epic. We were just before the interview talking about our kids and their Fortnite thing. I mean, how many times do you get people, like when you pick your child up from school, talking about this, asking you questions, or like saying like, well, this game is bad for children? Or do you have to deal with that at all, Christian? Or is it not that bad?
I mean, it's pretty super common, like, you know, when you're interacting with parents, especially because most of the parents I interact with are my age or younger. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they're pretty familiar with games, but they're kind of detached from it a little bit. So they kind of understand the concept from something that they played when they were kids, or that they, you know, they play Fruit Ninja or Candy Crush. And so they understand, quote unquote, what games are. But you know, when their kid has come to them and, you know, asked them for, you know, to buy the latest skins in Fortnite, or to play Roblox for another 90 hours or whatever it is, you know, they'll ask me stuff. And sometimes that bleeds out into technology as well. They'll just assume, you know, I got hammered by a parent recently about Discord and like why I, you know, let kids go on Discord. And I'm like, okay. And they had no idea what Discord was. They thought it was like Twitter. They're like, oh, you know, it's the Discord. The kids were on the Discord. And so I had to explain what chat rooms and servers, and I'm like, didn't you use AOL Instant Messenger? Like, didn't we all do this? Shouldn't we all understand this? But you know, it's relatively common. And then you get a lot of parents that are, you know, hey, my kid wants to be a pro gamer. Hey, my kid wants to be a YouTuber. And of course, they don't know the difference between those two things, right? They don't understand the difference between programmer and streamer and game developer. To them, it's all just playing games or making games. They don't really. So I spend a lot of time explaining those kinds of things.
A one man media literacy band kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And Angie, I mean, you're playing, among other things, you know, Fortnite with your kid, right? I mean, you're doing it together.
Yeah, and also I love playing it together with the kid. So he's 10 years old, and we play a lot of the duo mode. So it's really something that we do together. It's great because you can argue about, you know, tactics for every match. We take turns in choosing where we're gonna spawn. And it's just really nice to do something together. And for me, it also brings back how I grew up myself. Like I grew up with a mom who was also really into gaming. So we had, I think our first console was really like a Pong machine with those very crappy old, you know, controllers that you would have to like clean all the time because they would get rusty so quick. And then we later upgraded to it's called a Philips VideoPack G7. It had like these big cassettes that you had to push in, and then you would be able to play Pac-Man. And then whenever in the weekend, when it was raining outside, it meant that we, you know, would bring out the console and then we'd play with my mom and my younger sister. So I think I grew up with it also already being like something like a family thing that you can do together. And now, now to do that with my own kid is just, it's just really a lot of fun. Also to, you know, meet his friends online. I need to behave a little bit like I cannot be the mom, like just talk about what's happening in the game and not ask like, you know, mom questions. So,
I'm
enjoying it a lot.
I really appreciate the trip down memory lane, Angie, because that kind of is a perfect lead in to what I want to kick us off with today, is this notion of look, I mean, the game industry is an incredibly exciting industry. It's super fast developing. I mean, it's relatively young, right? I mean, like 20, 30 years ago, we could barely talk of a game industry, and now it's arguably, at least commercially, the biggest media industry in the world. And you've both sort of grown up alongside with this industry, getting involved in titles both small and huge along the way. So my question, just to get us, like what originally attracted you to this industry? I mean, I know, Christian, I mean, you started out as a modder for, I think, on Rainbow Six. And Angie, like from being just an avid game player and enjoying that so much, you went into multimedia design originally before joining a Guerrilla for the Killzone, the first Killzone game. But so what drew you originally to games and making games, and what continues to do that for you? What continues to inspire you about this industry? And Angie, maybe you can pick up where you left off.
You know, when I was growing up, the profession of game developer never even crossed my mind. You know, you didn't have any schools for it either. But I was always very creative. So I went to study industrial design. And within that study, there was a specialization called human-computer interaction, which was all about how humans interact with computers and computer interfaces. So that's how I sort of got into multimedia design. Back in the day, that was quite limited if you think about the technology that was available. Picture designing a game with only 256 colors, for instance. Or, I remember devices running really obscure operating systems that could do animation with 4 frames per second. But that was always the most interesting, I think, aspect for me, the fact that human interacting with an interface to sort of design the, let's say, ideal experience. And then, of course, if you look at games, I think it's the most complex, interesting way of how humans can interact with a bit of software. That's how I actually got into Guerrilla. They back in the day, this is almost 20 years ago, they signed an exclusivity deal with Sony PlayStation for a PlayStation 2 game called Killzone 1, a long time ago. And they needed somebody to help them out with the design of Killzone 1. And they then, they asked me, I know a couple of the programmers there. And for me, I think the technology was really what then also drew me to that, because at the time, and it's really hard to imagine right now, but the PlayStation 2 was this so credible machine. So in my head, I was already going like, oh, I can finally do like animation with like a proper frame rate, do some cooler stuff on the rendering side. So that's sort of how I joined Guerrilla and then never left. And I'm not sure if you first want to hear Christian's story or I can continue to talk about why I'm still here.
well, maybe we can swap origin stories. That would be a good idea, because Christian, I mean, you were in the military, you were a game modder, and then is it like a slowly but surely development into full-on game design, or was there a pivotal moment? What happened in your background?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, you know, now that I'm older and I'm kind of reflecting back, and as I talk to more and more people about, you know, games, is, you know, especially since I joined Epic, I travel a lot, talk to folks a lot more than when I was a line developer. And I realized I was always, I started, I peg my game design career starting at age 11, when I grew up in Alaska, and me and my mother, we went on a road trip. And a road trip in Alaska is what you can imagine it is. It's camping out of the back of your car for on a dirt road, the Denali Highway. But in exchange, I talked her into taking me to the local comic book store to buy me some Robotech books, because I'd been watching Robotech on cartoon or whatever it was that back then. And when I got to the comic book store, they were out of Robotech books. They didn't have any, the old Palladium ones. And so I'd asked, when are you going to get them in? I can't get back to this was the big city. I'm not going to get back for a couple months. And they said, well, we have this other game called Battletech, and it's basically just the same kind of thing. I said, oh, okay. And they didn't know anything about it. And so I bought it and took it on this 10-day road trip, which Battletech is like a strategic turn-based, board combat game. And I immediately started changing the rules, where it was too complicated. I was 11. This game's made for late teens, probably earliest. There's a lot of math. It's very complicated. I'm trying to teach my mom, who was an avid chess player, but, wasn't into combat armor games. And so I started making up rules on the fly. And, I think any kid that gets into games, you start getting into the fiction and the background and you're, telling stories in your head and writing and things like that. And then around that time, my grandparents owned a business, a equipment business, and my grandmother had purchased a computer for it. I don't remember if it was a 286 or an 8086, but basically first gen PCs. It was a Franklin with two floppy drives, no hard drive. And she couldn't figure out how to use it to do accounting. She was very old school, and she had her books, and she was like, I think my grandpa probably bought it for her and said, here, go make all the accounting better. And she was like, I've been doing accounting for, 35 years. I'm not touching that thing. So it just sat in the corner of the business, and they let me start playing with it. And, then modems came and BBSs and downloading and mods and Doom, and everything kind of escalated from there. And so I went in the military, my late teens, got married, did all that fun stuff. And when I got out, me and my buddies started LAN parties on Friday nights, the classic basement, lug your PCs in, and everybody played StarCraft. And well, it was more like Age Empires, I think, than Age Empires and Quake. Yep. And then we got this game called Rainbow Six, and it was really cool. We really enjoyed it. We played a long time. We started downloading mods for it. And then when the sequel came out, everybody was really jazzed. But none of those mods that we liked worked for the sequel. So I sat down and backwards engineered how to make them work for the sequel. And I remade a bunch of the ones, and then that turned into a whole modding thing, got turned onto the modding community, made a ton of mods. And at a certain point, I was working for the state. I was a child support enforcement officer, which is like the worst job ever. And I was coming home and doing this all night long. And my wife was like, look, you either need to get a job in this or you need to quit, because you're spending 8 hours a day at work and then 10 hours a day in the office, making these things. You're not getting paid any money for it. This is dumb. I was like, get a job in it? What? was that a thing? And so that started that path. And a couple years later, after a lot of shenanigans of, sending off stacks of resumes to Raven and Ubisoft and Red Storm and 98 other companies, I probably, maybe if Gorilla was there at the time, I would have applied. And sneaking into E3 and, sending signature required resumes to the heads of every company that I could find. So that thinking that if the CEO signed for the resume, that it would be a better chance to get in the hands. And eventually I got hired at Red Storm, and that's kind of the roundabout way. But to your core question, I think I've always just naturally want to make gameplay better and make stories better and make characters better. I mean, I love watching B movies in the middle of the night being like, if I could have this raw footage, I could edit this into a good movie. Like, you're so close. Like, you know, all those little details. If I can tell, if this editor had just had another 2 months, this would be an awesome movie. And if this video game had just gone through one more QA pass, it would have been awesome. Or if they just tweaked this one thing, it would be a little bit better. And so that's what I really enjoy and what still kind of drives me today.
That technology issue, it's in your story as well. Like, you start out and it's like, you know, there was like little or no frame rate and only 256 colors. And of course, now we're talking about millions and millions and millions. And so, and being part of that development, I can appreciate from somebody looking at this on the outside that this technological context can seem a bit intimidating or overwhelming. Like, things go so fast. But on the other hand, from what both of you are saying, is this sort of core commitment to, you know, making the user experience better, making the gameplay better, making it more immersive, more involving, more rewarding to be part of as a player. That seems to be this, you know, regardless of the technological context, you just use the technology to fulfill that goal. Is that still what drives you today? Or is there something particular to the technological context that is really different now than it was in the past?
But yeah, I think for me, technology has always been something that inspires me creatively. So I think we find ourselves at Guerrilla, first of all, people who love to create worlds. So it's a world in which players can explore, solve mysteries. So it's really about creating a world and then ideally a world that people really buy into. This is what I find also a super interesting element. Like, I think the power of science fiction is that you can create a world that's different, but if you take it too far, people won't be able to relate to it anymore. So you need to find this balance of people still being able to relate it to their own lives. So that, I think that is super interesting. And we then always come up with ideas that sort of always cross a little bit the border of what's possible from a technical point of view. So whenever new hardware comes out, I see the whole team here like jumping up because they're like, oh, now we get to, you know, do all of these other ideas that we had. So I think there's a really nice, a nice loop there where the technology, let's say the technical improvements sort of feed also in the creator loop in that way. And it's not that we, that without the new technology that we couldn't do it. It just always makes us look like 5 years ahead. And I think we at Guerrilla really love this idea where you can always think big, dream big, and have this idea that with more power. And we always still need to figure out and how exactly will we make this happen, but it's something that gets people really excited here. And that's I think also very true for me personally, that because I think the games that you play, I know there's a game that you ship and then there's the game that people were thinking about 3 years before it shipped. And I know there's always a delta, and so I think that's sort of part of that creator loop where I think technology also inspires new ideas. And brings back really old ideas. I know we've had a couple of ideas in the team here that, we weren't able to do for maybe over 10 years simply because, you know, the technology would not have that type of power yet. So it's, I think it's more like an ecosystem almost where you have a team that's really, really enthusiastic about creating these big worlds, telling stories, have the player experience things that you could never do in real life. And then you then also need to have the technology to enable those user experiences.
Christian, what role does technology, I mean, of course, at the moment you're a technology evangelist, so yeah. I mean, like, but I appreciate what Angie is saying about this sort of feedback loop that where the technology can be the driver of some innovation in the creative experience, but can also just be something like a tool that you can do to fulfill the dream that you've always had. How do you see this? And maybe specifically, like, maybe you can also explain a little bit about what an evangelist really is. I mean, because when I see Unreal 5, I just become excited. I don't need an evangelist, but I don't know. You explain to me what's going on.
Yeah, it's kind of two separate questions. Let me hit the evangelist ones first, and then I'll circle back on the evolution kind of things. But so as an evangelist, so I've been, you know, a game designer, creative director, lead designer. I did AAA, Ubisoft, Bungie / Microsoft for 26 days. Congratulations, by the way, on this week's news. Warner Brothers, ran my own studio for 5 years. And so I'd always used proprietary engines up until I went indie. So Ghost Recon had its own engine. Halo had its own engine at Warner Brothers, primarily focused on Lithtech. Although I also had the opportunity there to do hard engine evals of Unity, Crytek, and Unreal, which hugely benefited my career. So thanks, Warner Brothers. So evangelist, basically, the role is, and what I got hired to do was kind of two-facing. One is literally to pre-COVID to be kind of Epic's on the ground person in the region. So evangelists are kind of spread around the world. I think there's about 20 of us right now, and mainly focused in other regions besides US and Canada. So there's actually more evangelists in Europe and South America. And then at Epic, a lot of the other countries like China, Japan, South Korea, Australia have their own business divisions. But kind of just doing outreach about Unreal Engine. And they needed someone who could speak to AAA development, indie development, you know, using Unreal in linear entertainment, media, making film, all of those things I've done. Who's also, you know, comfortable with public speaking and telling everybody how great Unreal is. But the other component of that was to do outreach to indie game developers. Unreal Engine was about, I'd say, it was relatively early when I got hired in 2017. And Unreal 3 had been pretty closed off to smaller game developers. You had to get a custom license. They had kind of the UDK thing, which was kind of a modding subscription tool. But Unreal 4 was really kind of opened up to everybody. So it was really, you know, taking my experience, both good and bad, and being able to speak to the indie game developer, the AA game developer, the AAA game developer that's independent and maybe has been using their own engine for a long time and, you know, wants to go cross-platform or something like that, or just retire their ancient technology, which is always a hard pill to swallow, having been in a studios that have done it. So the term evangelist is, you know, kind of just someone that goes out and speaks about the product. But it's funny because, you know, for years and years and years, it was, what's a game designer do? Like, okay, programmers program and artists make the art and producers, you know, organize everything, but what's the designer do? Like, what do you design? And now I'm an evangelist. And so game designers are like, what's an evangelist do? So I always find myself in unique positions. It's always exciting. But as far as the maturation of technology and just the evolution of technology, it's interesting because, you know, what's kept me in this industry is the constant change and the constant challenge. Mm-hmm. I'm, you know, super, you know, the classic creative ADD, you know, tap my leg, start getting bored, doing the same thing over and over again. You know, when I was 23 and I was working for the state government, I had the path, I had the retirement down the road. All I had to do was do jobs that I didn't like, you know, 5 days a week. And I could roll on it. And it was infuriating. I couldn't kind of sit there and do it, especially coming out of the Marine Corps. But with games, it's, you know, there's something new all the time. I was so it was so amazing, and I didn't appreciate it at the time, but being able to design a new first person controller control scheme for the Xbox was an amazing opportunity. There wasn't, you know, Halo and Call of Duty and Killzone, the, you know, X does this and A does this and this is how it works and D-pad does this and, you know, you know, Angie gets it. It's like you're doing something new and you're just like throwing spitballs. And the first time someone, you know, held that D-pad down from Ghost Recon 2 on the Xbox and the four position menu popped up and then they automatically just D-padded again in the right direction to make the selection. And I had come up with that. Well, I don't want to say I came up with it because it's always a team effort, but I had kind of worked on that and thrown it together over a weekend because our last control scheme was just awful. And it worked. But with the maturation of technology, the huge bonus that I see is just in iteration time. Like that's what all of these technological improvements and, you know, making things look beautiful by default and render at, you know, an amazing frame rate without a lot of groundwork by the line developers frees up those line developers to iterate on their content. It frees up the, you know, editor, even in if we're talking about virtual production, you know, I worked on Lord of the Rings and that opportunity to go down and spend some time down with Peter Jackson and with Weta and seeing the sets on The Hobbit. And even then, even though that was cutting edge motion picture technology at the time, they still had to do things in post. You know, Peter Jackson still had to kind of, you know, take the renders and the concept pieces and, you know, kind of what was in front of him and say, okay, I'm going to put the sun over here. Right. But now a director can go move the sun over there and, you know, they're looking at their LED screens or, you know, maybe they're in VR. You know, they're seeing the, you know, the LED screens light the characters real time. They're not having to imagine, what is going to light on Anakin's face as lava flies by and no red shines on his face. And all the game developers go, that looks fake. So all of the things, you know, all of the technological advancement across engines, all engines and game technology in general, I think that the biggest thing is just allowing the developers to create that vision. And the danger, I think, and the challenge is, it's a lot easier, I think, to try to make the best decision out of, you know, three goals, three options, than, you know, an infinite number. You know, as a game designer, you know, when, you know, all the challenge I just came up against of, you know, hey, we want to have, you know, a different, you know, I wrote a story with 9 characters. Well, we can't roll 9 characters into memory in a cinematic at the same time. So you get 6. Okay. You know, and now obviously the studio heads and the producers will just come back now and say, okay, well, you wanted 9 characters, but you only have the budget for 6. So rewrite it. I think one of the challenges now is just, kind of reining yourself in and focus. And especially for indie game developers, one of the biggest things I talk about all the time, and I stole this from a developer that helped me early in the industry, John Sonnedecker, is, you know, shipping is a feature too. And shipping is the biggest feature. If your project never gets out the door, yes, you learn from it. And that's a benefit to yourself. If the players never get it in their hands or have the opportunity to give feedback, then all the other features that you crunched on and polished, they're kind of worthless if you don't nail the whole shipping part. So,
well, talking about shipping, Angie, you just gone gold, right? I mean, the game is shipped. It's gonna, yeah. And especially what Christian said, that is an incredible achievement. So congratulations. I want to use that also as a follow-up question about this reining yourself in. I mean, you've said in the past, you know, that in all our enthusiasm to make beautiful things, I think that's common across all media industries. And with all this amazing technology at your fingertips, you can get lost in the possibilities. Exactly what Christian was saying. And yeah, sometimes you have to remind yourself, like, what's our focus here? What's the essence of what we're trying to do? Now, both of you have been and are in leadership positions within your companies. I mean, you have to oversee teams. You have to sort of carefully manage these people. And these people are often people that are passionate about what they're doing. They love, their little character, their little scene, you know, that beautiful flowing water stream in your background, Chris, Angie, that's somebody's baby, yeah, right? That they worked on. And then you come in and it's like, well, people, we have to focus. So we're going to delete that and we're going to trim back that. And my question is, in two parts, like one hand, how do you do that? How do you, you know, keep your eye on the ball, keep focused? And that requires a certain type of management skill, a certain type of leadership. And I wonder, like, where does that come from for you? Like, how did you develop that? What has that taught you about yourself? And I realize this is a very personal question, but I think that is such a major skill for anybody working anywhere in the media that we sometimes don't make explicit, that, you know, we are human beings. And when we try to coach and help and be a leader to other human beings, especially those that are so passionately engaged with what they do, I mean, that is quite an achievement. So how do you do that? And what have you learned? Angie, you want to kick us off with that?
Yeah, I think over the years what I've learned is that it's so important to be a very good listener to people. And I think it's often underestimated, the skill of really listening. And as you were saying, people are super passionate about what they do. And I think this is true of most people who work in the industry. They're so passionate, or maybe in the creative industry, to be a good listener and also to be able to split the emotion out of what it is that they're saying. And also to be comfortable, I think, is the other important thing to learn, is to sometimes be comfortable that there's not a solution right away. And I think a lot of people in leadership positions have a tendency to go and solve on the spot, right? There's a big drama, there's a big issue, it needs to be solved. And it's okay sometimes to say, okay, this is a very complex problem that we need to solve. We're not going to do this here today. You know, let's take a bit of time, take a step back, and think about it, and also to be vocal about that, right? It's also, I think, good as a leader to say, listen, I also don't have a solution for that, even though I have all this experience. Doesn't mean that I automatically have a solution for everything. But we as a group, you know, we'll be able to break it down. Usually, I think every big problem you can break down in smaller problems, and one by one, we'll start solving them. I think for our team, we've learned this over the years that, you know, that in the end, we will always come up with solutions. So I think we as a team have really grown and become more comfortable with not knowing everything. And it's, I think particularly for creative people, it's really, it's not a nice feeling when you know there's huge problems and you don't have a solution yet. But to develop sort of confidence in that you will get there. So I think those are the important skills to develop. And I think a lot of it also comes with going through that. It's not something you can, I think, learn from a book, but to partly experience it and go through that process.
It almost sounds like parenting, Angie.
Parenting is easier, I would say. Easier.
Okay. All right. Interesting. Christian, rings true for you as well? Or did you pick up some other things about yourself along the way? How can you be a leader?
So Angie nailed it. You know, listening coming from, you know, really focusing on the design side, I used to joke, you know, your primary role as a game designer is the salesperson. Like you pull the team for what it really resonates from them. So you gather ideas and pitches and just you know, things that they want to do and that they think is cool. And you formulate that with, you know, adding in your own, what you want to do and what you think is cool. And then you, you know, pitch that back to them, because you have to convince them to do it as a leader, because if they don't want to do it and don't believe in it, then you're going to get a bad product, right? We all know that, you know, the more passionate the chef in the back kitchen, the chef team of making the perfect food and only caring about making that perfect food, that's going to be a better restaurant than the person that just doesn't care about making food and just wants to get a paycheck. But, you know, as far as leadership, I talking to people and explaining, and to me, you know, again, having, pinging off what Angie said, having been there and having done it, the more that you can expose yourself to different disciplines and realize that, you know, they all want their contribution to be as good as possible. And they want it to be as highlighted as possible and as seen as possible and as great as possible. That's what is driving them, hopefully, you know, unless they're there just to check a box. And then you have other issues that you have to deal with. But acknowledging that fact, and you know, you as a leader have to make hard decisions. And so you need to be able to listen to them and acknowledge that, you know, this is, you know, you're not telling me, I understand you want to add vehicles to the game because you feel that is the best thing for the game. And you happen to be a vehicle artist, and wouldn't it look cool if the player could drive them? But the reality is, you know, we have to focus on this or that or this. But you know, it's always amazing when I think across the spectrum, you know, you can be talking to, a prop artist, an environment artist, and be saying like, you know, why are you mad that I think the trees look awesome? And they're like, they are awesome, but the environment artist lit it and makes my trees look terrible. And, you know, I don't want my trees in this level if they're going to light it like that. And you're like, you know, having to deal with that. And then on the other hand, you've got a voice actor who's in a booth who has no clue. You're like, okay, giant spaceship's over there and it's purple and it's going to blow everybody up. And they're like, okay, I've had an hour brief and I'm going to do a bunch of yells and grunts and get out of here. And they have to trust you that, you know, their IMDb isn't going to get destroyed by your, you know, terrible production of their voice acting. So as far as, you know, what's within me, my thing has just always been, you know, how do we make the best game possible? And that's the driving force of how can we, this product needs to be as good as possible. And if, you know, if it means writing dialogue, I'll write dialogue. If it means designing systems, I'll design systems. But you don't want me anywhere near code, and I'm a terrible artist. So I'll just try to do the best that I can. Just kind of being there and trying to acknowledge again, you know, I think listening and acknowledging, like, you know, yes, you know, we all want the best thing. Sorry, that means your content has been cut. We'll try to make it up to you next time, kind of thing. But being there, communication.
Right.
Sometimes disaster projects can lead to good, products. I think, at least from my perception of Hollywood, there's a lot of times that you see an amazing movie and then, you know, you go back and see the behind the scenes and it's a disaster. But most of the time, I think disaster projects lead to disaster products as well. So,
Angie, you wanted to add something to this because you were going like, yes.
Yeah, just I think scope control is such a difficult thing to do. And I think a method that we always apply is that we also allow the team in the beginning of a project to really go wide. I think that's also what you need to be creative, right? You need to go wide, but then to also identify what we call project pillars. So there's a couple of pillars that we set for a project. And then once we start then looking at all the different IDs and start narrowing down the focus again, we always bring it back to those project pillars. So for instance, for Horizon Zero Dawn, one of the key pillars was majestic nature. So that was one of the key pillars of the whole project, that the if you were in the world of Horizon Zero Dawn, you should always feel that, that you're in this beautiful landscape. So it, it was, yeah, and that makes it easier, right? If somebody then has a feature, then you can actually say, well, does this actually help? Does it add to one of our key pillars, which is majestic nature? And that also often helps in discussion with the developers of, you know, we're not gonna, you know, bring your vehicles into the game because you would drive really fast and not even see the beautiful nature, for instance. and maybe this is a bad example, but I think that sort of helps also to talk to individuals while not making it your personal decision. No, this is the project. We have people in different roles who are the creative leadership, and they said, well, we have these three key pillars, and then we try and tie everything to those key pillars. And then we have statements. So it's majestic nature that you are in awe of because it's almost too beautiful for you to take in. And then it makes it easier. And then you can actually also explain why a certain decision is still maybe a great, maybe your feature is a wonderful feature, is great, but it's just not the right fit for this particular game. And right. Then we bring it to the next one. So that
opens the door to talk a little bit about the creative process or about creativity as a value. You mentioned it before, Angie. Like, I mean, particularly in creative industries or in industries where creativity is sort of the key to everything, which the media industry is. You're dealing with people who are, you know, they are intrinsically motivated. They're, in other words, they're passionate about what they're doing. And so creativity is key. But then again, what exactly is creativity? Because it's interesting, in the game industry, creativity is sometimes used to say, well, you can't be creative if you're working on a AAA game, because then you're, you know, there's so much pressure and commercial and market orientation. So you have to be indie or independent. Or people say, like, I can only be creative if I'm left alone to do my own thing. And, you know, I remember talking to game developers who would say, like, you know, yeah, I work at the studio during the day, but my best work is when I go home at night and I sit on my own computer and then I do the cool stuff and I bring that back the next day to the nightmare of the studio.
Doesn't sound too great.
Yeah, and other people would say, like, it's exactly the opposite, right? I mean, you're working on a bigger game, you're part of a bigger team. Yes, there will be strong personalities and people are passionate and there might be conflicts, but that actually produces a really great creative process, a collaborative process. So there's lots of different ways to think about and talk about creativity. Both of you have expressed yourself in the past about this in different ways. Maybe if I can ask, what does creativity, you know, back in the day, now after all this, what does it mean to you? What is at the heart of being creative in the games industry? What's that about?
Want to go first, Christian, or shall I?
Sure, yeah, I'll take the easy one. That's a great question and a challenging one. I mean, I definitely, you know, in the past, I did a lot of press and interviews, you know, when I left AAA and went indie and suddenly didn't have a PR person telling me I could just do interviews with anybody. And sometimes that worked out well and sometimes not so much. But, you know, one of the things that I thought going indie and starting my own company and doing a Kickstarter and all that fun stuff is I thought I would have full creative freedom, right? I'd be able to just make the decisions that were exactly right for the type of game that I wanted to make for a very specific community of what they wanted. And I knew the community, I knew what they wanted, I knew how to do it right. And what I learned after 5 years a lot of challenges was that, you know, you always have a boss. You can be the creative director of a AAA franchise at a huge publisher, and you definitely still have a boss. Your team is your boss. Management's the boss. The corporate's the boss. Stock price might be your boss. And then as an indie, you know, developer, you know, your funding is your boss. You know, where did your funding come from? How are you funding it? Is it your bank account? Well, it's going to run out. Is it a loan? It's going to run out. Do you have to get a publisher? Do you have to get investors? You know, what's the current trend of the day? Is all the money in VR or AR or XR or consoles or PC or, you know, all those things? But ultimately, on either side, the player's the boss. You know, they're the ones that are going to decide the success of your product. You know, whether you're working on a $100,000 game or a $100 million game, you know, they're going to decide whether it wins. And sometimes things are out of your control. Sometimes decisions that were completely perfectly valid at the time, either for business reasons or technological reasons or market shifts, 3 years later, turned out to be, you know, the wrong call. And then you have to take responsibility for that and move on. But, you know, back to your actual question, creativity at its core, again, to me, it's just, it's, you know, if I want to do something, I want it to, you know, enrich something else. I want it to enrich people's lives, and I want it to be, you know, appreciated in some way, shape, or form, whether it's industrial design, or game design, or if I had some kind of artistic ability. I guess I paint miniatures pretty good. You know, you want it to be appreciated. And so to me, it's always just how I kind of approach things in life is just looking at, you know, what's the problem to solve? How can I make this the best way? And I think, you know, Angie nailed it, you know, talking about the pillars is, you know, how can I make the right decisions that support that? How can I make the right decisions that are going to, that are going to make this the most beautiful and impactful thing that it could possibly be. And whether that's using my own skill set or recognizing and leveraging the, you know, amazing creative people around me and saying, oh, well, this person, you know, does the most amazing X. So, you know, you learn pretty quickly when you should just shut up and go, hey, you know, amazing concept artist person. I'm kind of thinking in this vein, I'm going to leave now and come back. And out of those 10, this is the most amazing that I like the most. Not going to that amazing concept designer and being like, hey, I found a bunch of pictures on Pinterest and I'd like you to draw this. But in the style of Dune, you know, like go do me 50 renditions of that. Because you're just cutting off the nose to spite the face right there. You've already drawn them into a box, and you could just, you know, go contract someone to do paint over. You could just run a Photoshop filter over that, you know? I don't think I answered your question, but that's my meandering thoughts on what you asked, I guess.
I'm sorry. I just had this while you were describing Christian, this vision of, I don't know if both of you are watching Mythic Quest.
Yes. No, not yet. I love it.
We're telling our students to watch these kind of shows about what is, like, I think there's a scene in one of these Mythic Quests about like some guy standing in front of the teams like, I envision this and go create that and I'll see you in 5 hours. Like,
yeah.
It's like, wait, what?
Doesn't quite work like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that show is excellent, particularly I think if you're a game developer, because it really hits on a couple of the cliches, I think, about the industry.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's really funnily made. Yeah, you know, I think being creative, in essence, I think is creating something that isn't there yet. And if you do that by writing a book or making a game or a movie or a painting, I think that is what, in essence, it is. And I think it also means that if you want to be a creative, check if you actually enjoy that process. Do you enjoy staring at a blank canvas and having to come up with stuff? Because I think there's a lot of people who like to see themselves as a creative or wanting to be a creative, but it also comes with accepting that is the process, and that there's there's not necessarily people telling you what to do. It's like you, it needs to come from a certain urge to create something. Because it has a really nice ring to it, right? To be creative. Like, it never sounds negative, right? To be creative. It's, right. It sounds cool. But it's not always cool. I think being, because when you then start being creative, you end up problem solving. And it's, I think, particularly in game development, you try to solve problems of, in the end, making an experience for somebody playing this game to be what you had envisioned. And even though I think as game developers, we often think like, okay, wow, we now have this level. Yeah, perfect lighting, special effects are in it. Then you take it to play testing, very painful moment, usually the first time. And that's when you see that the people for which you're making this game, they take, you know, they don't go to the left, they actually go to the right. And you're just watching it going like, how is this not clear? Or maybe they play your level and then they get interviewed later, like, so what did you think? And then they say something like, nah, boring. As where you thought you had this really great adventure level designed. Because it's also, I think it's quite easy as a creative to be, yeah, you have this idea in your head, this goal to sort of create a blind spot. So you end up maybe developing a bit of funnel vision where you just don't see your mistakes anymore, or things that sort of distract from what you're actually, what you're trying to achieve. So it's I think that the being creative is more than just, it sounds always so nice. I remember it from when I was younger, thinking like, yeah, if you're an art director, that sounds very cool, or movie director. But I think it's always good if you start working in the creative field to do that reality check with yourself. Are you enjoying this process? Do you actually like it to stare at problems and trying to solve them in new different ways that nobody else has ever done before? Or sometimes I think it's also okay to be to reflect on that and go like, am I actually enjoying this? I think the people that I see thrive best or do their best work are people who really, really enjoy this process of always coming up with new things, trying out new things, trying out different processes. So it's a lot of embracing change, embracing the unknown. And then in AAA, it also means do this as a 400 people team in our case, which if you talk about the individual freedom, the freedom to create what you want, I think you maybe only have that as a, if you're an artist who doesn't work for a client. Maybe then you might still have the budget issue. But yeah.
Yeah, but an artist still needs to get her work into a gallery and into, you know, so there you have that, the ecosystem that Christian also talked about. So yeah, that's I really appreciate this two-step flow, if I'm interpreting this correctly in your answers, right? On the one hand, to create, to solve a new problem or to create something from scratch, to come up with a solution. Like, I love the anecdote about how to use the controller, Christian, that you talked about earlier, right? It's just something brand new that didn't exist before, and that clearly makes a difference in conjunction with this loyalty or this service mindset towards the player. Like you said, the player is the boss, right? You want to make the experience better. You want to, you like what you said, Angie, you look at the play testing and you go, they're all turning right. No, how do I get them to turn left?
On controllers, when we were doing Killzone 2, and I think this was around the time when there was, let's say a control scheme started to be established.
Yeah.
In first-person shooters, at least. Mm-hmm. It was around that time, and we were doing our first playtest. We're using our QA group that Sony has to do our first multiplayer playtest. And we had changed R2 to throw a grenade, which is really silly if you think about it now. But then that was sort of, we were still figuring out what would work. And some people in the team also had complained. They were like, it just doesn't make sense. You know, this other game just started doing it like this. But you sort of then, people, you sort of accept that, this is what we now have. So 6 months later, we go to this playtest. So we're standing there. We had 32 players. You know, the build was stable. Always quite tricky to have something that's stable that you can actually playtest with it. And then the game started and everybody starts throwing grenades. And we're like, why are they throwing grenades? And of course, it hit instantly. It's like, oh yeah, the control scheme does not make any sense. Okay, that's, yeah, okay. We had forgotten about it. But this just shows also, I think, how easy it is to take the wrong direction.
Yeah. The interesting thing, I mean, the whole story of like these things with controllers and I think that that's important to recognize that we're talking about a development that's less than 20 years old, right? I mean, to some extent, of course, games have existed longer than that, but figuring out these kind of things or things that are now kind of, well, like, yeah, obviously that wasn't that long ago when we like had these major breakthroughs. And the way you both of you talk so reflectively about, you know, the gamers and the players and the, who are the boss and I mean, it suggests sort of like, you know, building on a long tradition of wisdom but in fact, the game industry is still brand new if you compare it to journalism or film
absolutely.
So in that context, it also has had to come to terms with a lot of issues that all the other industries had to have, you know, have had 100 years to deal with, also still haven't figured it out. But the game industry has had 20 or 30 years and sort of, you know, things with, you know, the fact that not that long ago, the game industry was a bunch of people, generally guys, sitting together in a room tinkering on the computers, a little bit like what you told us about your origin story, Christian. And now the game industry can be teams of exactly what you're doing at Guerrilla, with 400 people stretched across continents, working on a game with a budget of millions and millions of dollars. And it's the game, so you have that to deal with. There's always debates about inclusivity in games, both in the characters as well as in the workforce. There's unionization, collective organizing going on, workers realizing, oh yeah, we're part of a global workforce, and wait a minute, what's that all about? So on the one hand, that's all very brand new and issues that other industries have dealt with for a long time. But you flip that, and what always strikes me as an outside observer is that the game industry is the only of all the other media industries that has always been very public about all of this. I mean, the Game Developer Conference, the IGDA, International Game Developer Association, from early on started publishing reports about quality of life. I mean, I don't know any other industry that even does that today. Game industry has done this for, you know, the last 15 years. And making this a very open, very public debate, also engaging with these debates with gamers themselves, challenging gamer communities, as well as including them in this process. So I guess my question is, I mean, to me, these are all issues of professionalization that, you know, journalism or advertising have been dealing with for 100 years. You've done this for 20, 25 years. How do you see this process? How have you experienced this sort of growing up so quickly as an industry and being part of that industry? And how do you see the industry and this particular aspect of professionalization moving forward? And I'm also asking both of you, not just because of your leadership position, but you've both been very active in this space at IGDA, at the GDC, speaking out on this, getting involved, and of course, always being really generous with your time, including today, talking to students, to schools, to researchers. So I feel you're good people to ask this question to.
I'll let Angie start on this one.
Fair enough.
Thanks, Christian. Yeah. There's a lot of questions.
I
think maybe if I can. So I am indeed very active, for instance, with GDC. I'm part of the advisory board of the GDC, which for me came, well, they asked me a couple of years ago, well, maybe a bit longer already, to join that board. What I've always loved about our industry, even when back in the day when it was much smaller and maybe less professional as it is now, is that you meet people who are so passionate about what they do, but also very willing to share and to share lessons that they learned. And I think this might be a difference with some of the other industries where it's more people, you know, keeping things secret, or they don't want to give away their secret ingredients maybe, or their recipes. I've always found that the games industry, people are so willing to share and to help each other to make games. So I think they find the or they recognize the passion for making games, and therefore want to help each other to, you know, not make the same mistakes. That's what I personally love about the Game Developer Conference that happens every year in usually March in San Francisco, where the center of San Francisco becomes this. It's like game developer city if you walk in the city center. And you can go to talks about all these different aspects. And of course, this also started out much smaller. It's now a huge, big conference. But it did start, I think, from a genuine passion that people felt. And also, I think it's sort of the joy to meet like-minded people who are as interested in making games as you are. So I think for me, that's maybe something that I really love about our industry. And then the fact that certain topics then actually also come up, like the Game Developer Conference always made those topics, put them up for discussion. You know, there were topics that were discussed in like roundtables. And I think it was great. It created a platform for more people to start thinking about them. And I think because you do have this group of open-minded people who like to do new things, they will take those topics and the lessons learned also from talking to each other and make change. So to make changes, I think that's something that game developers are quite good at. Mm-hmm. So if you, for instance, take representation in games, when you think about diversity, we had a huge issue in the game industry with the Gamergate around 2014, I think that was. And I think it's quite impressive to see how quickly new products started to roll out that actually acknowledged that we had been using maybe a more stereotyped view of certain things and to start changing that. So I think it's quite powerful to see that. And I don't know if it's because the industry is young or because the type of industry that we are, mm-hmm. but I think it's quite powerful to see that change is actually happening. And that is something I think also that, gives me quite positive outlook for the future.
It might just be that just because the game industry is relatively young, it's less sedimented, if that's the right word, as for example journalism or advertising or film could be. Like they have to overcome like a long history of this is the way we do things around here, yeah. Which in the game industry is old hat 1 year down the line. So would that be valid?
I think so. Definitely, I think part of it, I can maybe also only talk about Guerrilla. I think whenever we ship a project, we do a big postmortem. We look at everything that didn't go so well, to then see how we can do it better the next time. And also the things that did go well, we also look at how we can then even, you know, make that a better process going forward. So there is, I think, a natural loop of always seeing how can we change how we do things to become better at it. So we've definitely not found like the way to make games. Like it's still
right.
Something that we iterate on. I think that might be true for a lot of studios.
Christian, this openness towards change and a willingness to be open about it, not just within your small group, but within the game community in general, is that something you recognize as well? Or what is this sort of professionalization history? How have you experienced it and what's your take on it?
Well, very similar. I think one of the unique things about games in general and especially one of the things that was very unique about the games industry in, say, the early 2000s is that you generally had most studios were groups of people that except for usually the core of wherever they were, they had brought people in from, you know, different areas, different regions, different backgrounds, different expertise. And then oftentimes you had to then, you know, even outside of your studio, start dealing with folks from different countries. You know, you couldn't just say like, I'm only going to make my product in the state of Tennessee and ship it in the state of Tennessee and never interact with anybody outside the state of Tennessee. Well, I guess you could, but you wouldn't be profitable. So, you know, you had this influence of, you know, people that naturally want to share and want to communicate and want to be creative, that have, you know, communication barriers, you know, whether it's physical distancing and language barriers and, you know, different cultural backgrounds. And so we tried to solve those problems as game developers, and GDC is a great example that was always very open. You know, it was kind of the place to go to, as long as you didn't, you know, you had to be super secretive about what you were working on right now, but let's sit in this, you know, giant round table and talk about, you know, the definition of a game designer, or, you know, how do we do game credits, or, you know, gosh, I remember in 2002, how do we solve work-life balance, which we've all solved by now. So
yeah, we're done with that. Yeah.
Yeah. Fine. And you know, things like, you know, everything from, you know, representation of games. I mean, this isn't something that's, you know, just happened in the last couple of years. These are discussions that I've been having for 20 years. You know, what, you know, hey, I had arguments about whether females and women should be represented in Ghost Recon, because at the time, women weren't allowed to be in the United States in the special forces. And I was like, well, this is set in the future, and in the future, it's going to be different. And guess what it is? Now it's different. I think the difference is that we recognize as game developers, there's often, the things that you need to keep a secret, usually that's not what makes your game amazing and what makes your art amazing, right? Mm-hmm. If you're a character artist and you're sitting there and you can't put, you know, the next, Mario into your portfolio, and you've built that new Mario and it's sitting there for a year and a half, you have to keep that off your portfolio. The number one thing you want to do as soon as that game gets announced, and as soon as that character, you know, gets released, and now you have authorization to put it in your portfolio, you want to go tell everybody about how you built it, the decisions that you made. Like, you want everybody to know about it. And so there's just that natural drive to share those things. And then, you know, I think back to what Angie was saying about evolving and what you're pointing at, because the industry is so rapidly changing, and we never really acknowledge it, that in 3 years, there could just be a massive seismic shift in how we monetize products. And that happens all the time. You know, the transition from, you know, a first person shooter, I'm going to work on it for 2.5 years. It hits the door in August. It hits gold in November. I can take time off between. We start working on patch one, DLC one, ship that out the door. Then we roll onto our expansion pack and ship that out in 6 to 8 months. Like, all those things are gone as soon as you have a successful game these days, because it's a live services game. You know, how are you going to be supporting this over time? You know, what's your process for, are you going to have an A and B team that's rotating on and off? Are you going to, you know, how are you going to organize that? You know, as soon as, you know, some new platform rolls out, things are completely different. And so I think because we have that flexibility, it doesn't always go well. The thing that we forget, I think, as an industry is, you know, anytime there's kind of a shift in whether it be, you know, how we approach making games, platforms, monetizations, there's plenty of companies that flame out and don't do well in that disintegrate. And, but all those people then go to the other companies, ideally, and share their learnings of, let's not do what happened at my studio, because, you know, we didn't make a game that folks found accessible to them, and nobody bought it. So That didn't work. Let's try, maybe if we make a game that'll appeal to more people, we could sell more copies. That might be something that we could try. So, you know, I think you have to be flexible, and you know, that's just required. And if you aren't, you will not do well long term, and you'll go find something else to do. Yeah, that's kind of how it rolls.
I want to circle back to something we talked a little bit about in the beginning as well, which was and it speaks, of course, directly to your job right now, Christian, with Unreal 5, but also with the New Horizons Zero Dawn. I mean, Guerrilla Games is also special studio in that you've always used also your own game engine, Decima, and the reason why I'm asking specifically about that is, and especially in the context of Unreal 5, what you see happening, and also in the context of what we just talked about, how other industries are looking at the game industry, not just for the innovative ways it makes its money, right? It constantly develops new business models, and not just in the way it deals with its audience. Like you said, the player is the boss. There's this very strong sort of player gamer oriented culture in the industry, where gamers play an active role in the process, like through game testing, modding. There's a lot of community management. The community engagement is a huge deal for studios like Guerrilla. So there's this real intense relationship that other industries can only dream of. I mean, I'm thinking specifically of journalism, but and now we're having these new technologies, these game engines like Decima, like Unreal 5, that. And Christian, you already mentioned it. They're moving into virtual production, right? Virtual production for film and television is now made possible by these kind of technologies that came out of the game industry. How do you see this development? I mean, do you sort of see an increasing maybe convergence or integration of film, television, games, you know, creating sort of a multimedia industry? And is this a good thing? I mean, is this exciting? Or and of course, there's exciting parts about it for sure. But you can also say, well, there's a lot of merit in keeping these worlds kind of separate, but let everybody do what they do best. And Angie, for you as well. I mean, one of the many ways in which Horizon Zero Dawn has always received praise was for its cinematics, like you just mentioned, this absolutely gorgeous environment. I remember in your old studio there was this film studio in the basement. And of course, Decima has evolved over time, becoming increasingly complex. How do you see those developments of games industry and other media industries sort of coming together, maybe converging, establishing a dialogue? I'm sure there's great exciting opportunities, or do you also see perhaps some problems down the road? How do you see this developing? Maybe Angie, I can ask you first, and then Christian can talk specifically about Unreal because of its dual focus.
Because I think Unreal is, of course, an engine made for a huge audience, is where Decima is made for us, only for us at Guerrilla. We, I think, love to have our own engine because it allows us to focus on those aspects of engine technology that we need for the games that we make, so it can really tailor it super specific for those things that we want to do. And to answer your question about different media and the synergy, it's true. I think that the storytelling in games has become more cinematic if you compare that to story games 10 years ago. I think it's really a huge leap, and we indeed have our own mocap studio where we do a mocap to motion capture the animation, the bigger stages that you can use for mocap mostly are we don't have the one of them at Guerrilla, but Hollywood, there's a couple that we would normally use. Now with the pandemic, we had to get creative and use a different process. But I think you also see that talent is now more used to take a bigger role in a game and also be more vocal about it. We just announced Carrie Ann Moss plays one of the roles for Horizon Forbidden West, for instance, or Angela Bassett. I think that is also a new well, not super new trend, but something that you see the last couple of years. You see those the big Hollywood talent, also being proud of playing a role in a game rather than in a film or a TV series. So there's I think definitely, and this is I think also enabled by technology, on the story side, a more cinematic influence, I think, on games, not on all types of games, but definitely on the ones that that we make at Guerrilla. But then looking at our engine, we purely develop our engine for games. That's a very clear focus for us. But yeah, I think we're in a very different position than Christian, I think, with Epic, where Unreal, of course, is made for hopefully a huge audience to be creative with.
With Unreal and especially with Unreal 5 coming, the engine is built to be a core for multiple different developers. As it's evolved and we've taken the lessons from games and brought them to other industries, and I could literally spew forever going outside of games, TV, architecture, app and vision, HMI and vehicles, simulation, so much power that the real time brings to the fingertips of folks that weren't used to that before, is huge. But specifically in film, I had the opportunity to do some crossover work where, when I was at Warner Brothers, I got to go down and work on Mad Max and meet George Miller and be down in Australia, Lord of the Rings with Peter Jackson working on The Hobbit. Then when I was independent, I worked on After Earth, which was Will Smith's big and Jaden Smith's big movie debut. That was going to be my big Hollywood break. I was unfortunately the movie didn't do all that great, and that was my transmedia experience. Bringing those the opportunities to virtual production and that crossover. I mean, Epic had people deployed on the set of The Mandalorian, using Unreal Engine to to both light the sets and build backgrounds and do things in real time that to game developers are just normal things. They're just like, well, of course you're going to look at the model in the lighting environment that's going to be shipped on the platform and delivered to the player. Of course you're going to do that. If you only look at it in 3D Studio Max and you never look at it in engine in game, it's going to be different no matter what. No matter how much you think it's going to be the same, it's going to be different. And so bringing that kind of that sense of development, that sense of production to other industries, and being able to blow their mind in architecture when you're showing someone a space and you're just like, okay, now I'm gonna swap out this wall with windows, and guess what, this is set up real time in Sydney. This is the actual apartment that you're going to be showing, and if we throw a window here, let's do you want to what time do you want to see it at? 4:30 p.m. You want to see how the light comes through the window and shines off the leather couch that you picked out and moved over here? Like, let's do it. And to me, I think all of that then rolls back and benefits the industry mainly from talent acquisition, right? It's always been a challenge for our industry. We always need more folks, more talented and skilled folks. And if someone can get good at something like Unreal Engine or something like Unity or something like Godot, and they can make really good products in it, then they're going to be able to make really good products in a proprietary engine that a game studio may have been used, because those tools are going to be, like Angie said, tailored for the type of content that they're going to do. So I think I don't see a lot of negative. Like, it's funny because you use the term convergence, and to me, I don't, Epic, we use it a lot as well. But I have kind of a bad taste in my mouth from the actual term convergence, because in the mid 2000s, when I worked for Ubisoft, convergence meant let's make more video game movies. Let's, King Kong did great. Let's make Beowulf. Like, that's like convergence meant having your game studio make an animated movie of your IP, you know, make a, you know, 3D rendered Assassin's Creed movie, or, you know, or sometimes maybe it meant like, you know, the Animatrix in video games. It wasn't, or the convergence of, you know, mixing Animatrix, there was supposed to be a video game, or there was a video game. But it kind of meant like, it didn't mean that the kind of sharing of technology and sharing of, you know, creative IP across the board. It was more of like, let's be like Hollywood. And I think what we've learned as a games industry is, while, you know, we're still, I think, a little enamored with Hollywood, and we like to make our award shows look like Hollywood award shows, and you know, we kind of want to do that, but we realize now that, you know, as an industry and as creatives, we've matured enough to where our product and our vision of you know, what we can create stands up, you know, against any of the you know, what's on movies or TV, especially coming out today. So again, I think I have let my ADD take over and lost the original train of question, but
maybe nice to mention, because I think there's still one big difference if you look at the technology bit, and if you have a game next to a movie, for instance, and that's the fact that we need to do everything real time.
Yes.
If you have a movie, you know exactly, you have a storyboard, you know exactly how long every shot is, you know what you need to build in the background, you know, you can already start on the music, and you know what sound effects that you need, and you have a pretty waterfall approach to that. With a game, you don't know. We can have this big story scene happening here, but the player can just turn around and walk away. Or maybe, you know, he has a weapon. Maybe there's a bow and arrow. You can shoot something down. And there's maybe a thousand objects that can be shot. But if they hit the ground, they need to have a sound, right? And if it's a metal object, you want it to sound different than if it's like maybe a plant that you shoot off a tree or something. So you need to start thinking systematic, real time. And it's a very different way of creating content than film. And I think to the process that Christian was just talking about with The Mandalorian, for instance, they do things that for game developers are quite normal. It's like, yeah, of course, you can real time change the sun and then see if that looks better. Like, that's because we're so used to creating real-time content. So I do think there's lots of opportunity, I think, there to take lessons from. But in the end of the day, I think that the game will still be a game with as an interactive media, where and a film will be more a passive medium. Like, if you make a film, you have full control about what the end user will see, and you don't need to. You don't need to think about how the user will interact. You, of course, hope that you can evoke emotions and all of that, but you don't need to think about the interaction of the gamer and the endless possibilities that can create.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Now, I want to end our conversation, because I realize I'm already taking a huge chunk of your time. With something that was briefly mentioned in our conversation, which was what did you, Christian? Oh, we talked about quality of life 20 years ago, so we figured that out. And talking about quality of life and work-life balance, I mean, like, here you are, both of you, generously spending your time early in the morning, and I know, Angie, for you it's late in the evening, talking with me and with everybody who's listening and watching. How I guess, and a lot of people who will watch this, who will listen to this, are people who will be considering a career in the games industry, or want to learn more about what that's really like. And of course, the question of work-life balance, or just, you know, making the right decisions along the way, balancing your passion and your creativity that we've talked so much about, which I really appreciate your thoughts on, with, you know, also, you know, having a life, even though having a life also means creating amazing things. I mean, I think that's a challenge for anybody, anywhere, and especially in the media industry, and particularly as we're talking about the games industry. So maybe a final word of wisdom from both of you who are not just making amazing things, but also being so generous with your time, for which you don't have time. And I really appreciate that. How do you make the right decisions in this way? So I'm not asking you, how do you achieve work-life balance? I'm just saying, like, how do you make the right decisions? If I may pitch a possible answer, and I'll start with you, Ingi, is it like you talked about the pillars, right? This in game design that ultimately you evaluate everything, whether it contributes to the key pillars that you've identified at the start. Is that also the way you make the good decisions about, you know, quality of life and work-life balance? Like, identify one or two pillars for yourself and test that, or is that too simple?
Yeah, no, I guess, yeah, no, that's not how I do it for myself.
Fair enough.
No, yeah, I guess for me, it's more, it's about priorities and energy levels. Mm. Like, you know, sometimes you can have a really busy week, and maybe you spend more hours because you got so excited about something, but you get energy from it.
Right.
Then, yeah, I'm just happy at it. And maybe the next week, maybe you did not work that many hours, but the type of work that you were doing wasn't as enjoyable or giving you energy. So maybe that might feel more draining. Mm. So I think what I've learned over the years is that you need to keep reflecting. Am I still enjoying what I do? I think if you don't really enjoy what you're doing, I think quite quickly you find that something might become draining. It's where if you are having the best time of your life, it can be a good thing.
Mm.
But you know, life can also be complicated. Sometimes maybe you have a busy period at work, and then something happens in your private life, you know. And I think to always then have something ready, like, and be able to, like, oh, can I, oh, I now need to deal with this other issue. Okay, maybe I do need to then also let some folks know at work that I won't be able to do this. Like, speak up about it, and don't think that just plowing through it is the way to go. I think when you're younger, maybe that's a little bit more tricky to do. Maybe this is also something that you need to practice, and you'll get better at it over time.
Hmm. Nice. Yeah. No,
I sound really old now. it just gets easier, I find, over time. And then, yeah, spending time with students, I actually love that, because I think I'm still, after so many years industry, super excited about the games industry. And I think it offers a great opportunity for so many people to be creative in different fields, you know, from composing music to writing story to doing game design to do animation programming. So I always enjoy speaking to students. So that's I think a priority I set, because it also gives me energy. I enjoy doing it, and I think it also serves like a good cause. It's a way to give back, I think, to society, to help with education. So yeah, always love that.
There's an evangelist in you too, Angie.
For the games industry, I guess.
Wonderful. Christian, the last word to you, my friend.
Well, I mean, on that subject, I still can't believe anybody pays me money to do what I do. I mean, this is still pretty amazing. And I still have to, you know, every once in a while, just stop and go, this, I get to do this for a living. This is, you know, the creative thing I want to do. And when I stop and I think about, well, what else would I do as a career that, you know, I would really want to do, and it would, you know, would be like a park ranger. Like, I'd want to be out, I'd want to be, you know, cliffhanger search and rescue in the national parks. Like, that would be amazing. But I'm a little old and broken for that. So, you know, I guess I'm stuck with video games. But, you know, I when I sit and really think about what else I would want to do that would replace this, I can never come up with that. And, you know, there definitely is an aspect of, you know, that passion, finding a balance between that passion for wanting to create and wanting to iterate and make the best thing. And this is your one shot, to realizing that if you're going to do games long-term, that that challenge is always going to be there. That schedule is always going to be there. That deadline is always going to be there. So you do have to take time to realize, you know, should I delay having a child until after the product launch? No, you should just have a child when it's right to have a child. Should you delay go seeing your grandma? She's not feeling that well, but we got a launch coming up. No, go see your grandma. You know, there's going to be always going to be another 2 weeks to work on the project. You know, take time for yourself and your family and recharge your batteries. You have to recharge your batteries. And, but the interesting thing is as you gain more experience and knowledge, you can spend less hours creating what used to take you more hours because you don't have to go through all those, you know, drafts and, you know, writings. I know people aren't going to like this, so I don't need to do a draft of, you know, this approach. I can just put that away. And as you gain, you know, the knowledge and experience of hearing what other developers have gone through, of, you know, analyzing other games and seeing what they've done good. And wow, that's amazing. I'm always going to do save games like that because that is the smoothest save game experience I ever had. Or I am never going to open a game like that because that is the worst opening of a game I have ever seen. And I will never do that. So I can just cross that off the list. You know, it is a challenge and it's a balance. And, you know, the joke of we solved it, I don't think that you can totally ever just turn it off. You know, you can't, you know, it will make playing video games a challenge. It's hard to find a video game that will speak to you, that, at least for me, that you don't spend all your time analyzing it. And, you know, going, well, you know, if they had just, you know, done this one thing, then it would have been good. But the rewards of, again, you know, being paid to make, beautiful, amazing interactive experiences that people get to enjoy. And, you know, in 10 years, when someone comes up to you, an 18-year-old comes up to you and goes, wow, I played that when I was 8 and it was amazing. Or a 28-year-old comes up to you and said, when I was 18, I played your game and I decided to, you know, go to school to make games, or I decided to go off and do this thing that you know, whatever inspired me, it's a constant reward. So yeah, a lot of challenges, but gotta find that balance, I think.
All about balance.
Yeah. Well, Angie, Christian, thank you so much for your time, your frankness, for covering just about everything that we can cover in this time that we have together. I'm going to wish you so much fun and all the luck with the launches. I mean, the new Horizon Zero Dawn, it's going to be fabulous. I mean, the new footage that came out this week is amazing. And I mean, I don't know, I'm sure you're following this religiously, Christian, but I'm hooked on all the fan videos that are coming on YouTube, people already using Unreal for their own little short movies, and they're incredible. I wonder how many movie directors or studios are shitting their pants because, you know, amateurs are going to take over and going to make things. That is just incredible. Amazing. Yeah, talk about having an impact. That is incredible. So both of you, thanks again. I'm looking forward to catch up at some other point soon.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Mark.
Cheers.